This episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hears from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing Watson X Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with Watson X Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Welcome to Brainstuff, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, Brainstuff, Lauren Vogelbaum here. Japanese samurai movies are a century-old tradition, and their tropes have been picked up in stories all over the world. George Lucas has said that one of his inspirations for the original Star Wars movie was a 1958 samurai film called The Hidden Fortress. Another classic samurai picture, 1961's Yojimbo, was loosely adapted into Sergio Leone western A Fistful of Dollars. Pop culture frames samurai as near-mythic figures. We're told samurai belonged to an elite class of Japanese warriors who always fought fair, loyally defended their medieval lords, and hewed to a unifying honor code known as Bushido. Filmmakers sometimes pit them against dark-robed ninja assassins, a fearsome mercenary. The classic movie ninja carries razor-sharp throwing stars and has mastered a martial art called ninjutsu. Many more modern tellings even give one or both of these characters supernatural powers like flight or invisibility. But magical talents aside, just how accurate is our modern outlook on samurai and ninja? To find out, we interviewed three historians. Japanese history is broken down into eras and periods. Particularly relevant to our discussion here are the Sengoku period of 1467 to 1603 CE and the successive Tokugawa period, or Edo period, that lasted until 1868. The latter Tokugawa period takes its name from a shogun family that assumed control of Japan in 1603. Shogun were hereditary military dictators who'd been running the country since 1192 CE. On paper, they served Japan's emperors. But in practice, these figures were far more powerful, and it was they who truly called the shots. Earlier centuries had been plagued by constant warfare, but things stayed calm under the Tokugawa regime. International trade was tightly regulated, and the shogun took pains to discourage political squabbles. This was also a time when Japan redefined its relationship with samurai. who we spoke with Thomas Conlin, a professor of East Asian history at Princeton University, via email. He explained, the samurai became an identifiable social status only in the 1590s. Before then, all of society was militarized, and there was no distinction between peasants and warriors. Such ambiguity didn't sit well with one game-changing warlord, General Toyotomi Hideyoshi. He issued a nationwide sword hunt edict in 1588 during the Sengoku period. This prohibited farmers from owning weapons of any sort. Under these new rules, only samurai, and samurai alone, could bear arms. We also spoke with historian Nick Kapoor of Rutgers University via email. He said, basically, people who were known to have fought in battles recently were considered samurai and were forbidden to go back to farming. And people who were known to be currently farming land had to surrender their weapons. In a lot of cases, it was self-reported, and people basically got to choose. Toyotomi's reforms carried over into the Tokugawa period. In effect, they laid the groundwork for a rigid, hereditary, caste-like system that put samurai above artisans, merchants, and peasants. By then, the feudal wars that defined the Sengoku period had long passed. With no battles to wage, the samurai were given bureaucratic and administrative roles. Hindsight sometimes has a way of glamorizing warfare. We also spoke via email with Sarah Thal, a historian of early modern and modern Japan who teaches at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She said, during the long peace of the Tokugawa era, when samurai came to work more as administrators than as fighters, many romanticized the earlier times of war in the 12th to 16th centuries, for instance, when samurai actually fought. The last shogun was overthrown in 1868, ending the Tokugawa period. Afterward, Japan entered its reformative Meiji period, which embraced industry and centralized governance. Historically, the samurai had served feudal lords and enjoyed special privileges, but all that soon changed. Thal explained, the official status of samurai was abolished in 1869, and their privileges revoked in the early 1870s. With the abolition of their lords' domains, many former samurai were out of work, unable to get jobs in the new government. In the 1890s, they, their children, and many Japanese began trying to define a way of the samurai that operated both as a nostalgia for the supposedly moral good old days and as a critique of the modernizing trends of the time. Enter Nitobe Idazo. A diplomat and author, he radically transformed the way future generations would look at samurai. In 1899, Nitobe published an influential book called Bushido, The Soul of Japan. The text presents itself as an introduction to Bushido. According to Nitobe, this was the traditional universal code of conduct observed by real-world samurai. Except it wasn't. Kapoor noted, the so-called samurai code of Bushido did not exist in the Sengoku heyday of samurai warfare. Indeed, the word Bushido itself wasn't coined until the peaceful Tokugawa period. But it is from Bushido, the Soul of Japan, that we get some of the most pervasive myths about samurai values and behavior. Thal said, samurai were not all the moral, noble, well-to-do, spiritual swordsmen depicted in film. They did not have a single coherent moral code that defined how they thought and acted. And Kapoor said, just like warriors anywhere else, samurai raped and looted and pillaged and were constantly betraying their lords. Speaking of misconceptions, it's time to talk ninja. Supposedly, they were sellswords who performed covert operations, gathered intelligence, and assassinated people in the cover of darkness. Iga and Koka, two neighboring regions in southeastern Japan, are usually cited as the training grounds where ninja honed their deadly skills. Sometimes you'll even hear that ninja formed a hereditary class or caste, not unlike the samurai. The lore is pervasive in pop culture. Every year, some enthusiasts even dress up to celebrate Ninja Day on February 22nd. Not to rain on anyone's parade, but these storied mercenaries are kind of fabricated. Kapoor said, ninja as we know them today did not actually exist. He explained that the word ninja comes from two Chinese characters meaning stealth and man, which is pronounced shinobi, by the way, by most Japanese language speakers. Medieval Japan had its share of folks who snuck into castles and embraced undercover warfare. Historical records show samurai weren't above such tactics. Kapoor said, We have a lot of documents about these activities, but they were carried out by a variety of people. There was never any specialized class of assassins living in hereditary clans and selling their services for hire. This is pure myth, which, like the myths about the samurai, was created during the long and peaceful Edo period. Despite this, ninja fables are nothing new. Tal said, even by the 18th and 19th centuries, ninja had become a pop culture phenomenon in Japan. So there were all sorts of fantastic fictional depictions in art, literature, drama, and the like. Today's episode was written by Mark Mancini and produced by Tyler Klang. For more on this and lots of other mythical topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Brainstuff is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Happy Pride from Tomboy X. We just dropped our Pride 24 collection. Queer founded, queer run, and creating size and gender inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. So you feel comfortable in your own skin. Visit TomboyX.com to shop.
You wouldn't expect to hear that we're America's third best city for beer like this one. Or home to vibes like this. And this. It might surprise you that we're top 10 for immersive art that's like,
whoa.
And not to mention, we have one of the top zoos in the country. So can a city with the country's best pro soccer team, ranking as a top culinary destination in the world, be in your own backyard? Yes, Columbus. Plan your summer at experiencecolumbus.com/summer.